Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is John Chambers. John is the chairman emeritus and former chief executive officer of Cisco Systems. During his 25 plus years at Cisco, John drove explosive growth in the company from $70 million in revenue when he joined to $47 billion when he stepped down as CEO. John's currently the founder and CEO of JC2 Ventures, where he helps disruptive startups from around the world build and scale. In our interview, conducted at his house in Palo Alto, California, John reflected on his 25 years at Cisco, from his greatest professional regret, to the key factors behind Cisco's massively successful acquisition strategy, to the critical importance of culture. We also discussed his work with leaders of France and India to digitize their countries, what he looks for when evaluating companies to invest in, insights from his new book, Connecting the Dots, Lessons for Leadership in a Startup World, among a variety of other topics. John, welcome to the broadcast. It's great to speak with you today.
Peter, it'll be a lot of fun, and it's exciting topics that we'll be covering.
That is absolutely the case. I want to, first of all, congratulate you on your terrific book, Connecting the Dots, Lessons for Leadership in a Startup World.
I want to thank you, and I want to thank you twice. You read the whole book, and I loved your candor about what you liked about it and what you thought we could do better, and we'll see if it achieves the results that I hope it will.
Well, I hope it does as well. I'd like to begin our conversation at this place where you began in the book, which is your roots in West Virginia. It's a place that really shaped you, and it's a place you've reflected a lot on in terms of its evolution, some of the issues that it has faced, especially in recent decades. I know that, and we can continue to get into this as to investments you're making and ways in which you're staying involved in the improvements in that state. But I wonder if you could just reflect for a moment on some of the key lessons you drew from your childhood in West Virginia, very, very different than the places where your children grew up, for example.
Well, it starts with the most basic one of all. We were a very tight family. And our family was very close with the relatives. And whether it's in cities like Charleston, West Virginia, or Ravenswood, or Morgantown, it was bringing together groups and being very open and watching out for each other. The second thing is it was a state that had more millionaires than the United Kingdom did, the chemical center of the world, the coal center of the world, etc., and that people really believed in giving back. And as I said in the book, if you had an accident and you had to go up and knock on a door in any state in the U.S., I'd want to be in West Virginia because those people would take you in and help you, almost without exception. But it also was a state that saw its ups and downs go based upon what I call market transitions. And every state, every company, every person will have times of really good success, and we'll have times of setbacks. And what I learned at West Virginia is from both the successes, but also the setbacks from which the state has not recovered. We used to be in the very tops in many of the areas, and now we're often number 45, 46, 47 out of the states, except in our football, which is really good. Hopefully in the top 10 this year. But it is lessons learned in terms of family, getting market transitions right, and the penalty when you miss market transitions, what it can mean not just to a company, but what it can mean to the state and the majority of citizens in a state.
You mentioned the University of West Virginia, where you went to university. And you also bring up in the book the role that education played.
Yes.
You are the son of two physicians, so there was a great deal of education in your immediate family and beyond. But you've also talked about how important it was for you to have a strong foundation from an education perspective. But there was a challenge there in as much as, and this is, again, something you share in great detail in the book, that you're dyslexic. And it meant, of course, that you needed to learn to learn differently. You had some a tutor who was particularly influential in your life.
Yes.
But you've also talked, as you go through the book, about some of the advantages of being dyslexic. You talk about how, in fact, 20% of CEOs you have heard, you've read, and you've known even many of them who've shared this detail with you are dyslexic.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the, sort of that that path, the of overcoming this issue, but also using it as a strength.
Well, our family, both my parents were physicians, as you mentioned, and it was a given that we would go to college and probably graduate school. We've had five generations of every child going to school, going to the universities, and most of them to West Virginia. And so it was a given that I'd be going, and yet all of a sudden, the second, third, and fourth grade, I was having real trouble reading. And my parents would work with me, and they'd read with me in the evening, but it's like a bad golf swing. If you're practicing something that is not good, it only makes it worse and puts stress on you. And I was fortunate enough, because my parents had been involved in education, and from the very beginning, it was a given that education was the equalizer in life, but you had to be in the right spot at the right time. Then later, I got to be part of the internet. And the equalizers were the internet and education. And something we may touch on later, the future is about a digital, artificial intelligence, startup world. And to maybe be able to bridge all three of those areas from education to the internet to a digital startup world would be fun. So it was the ability, because of a spatial teachers before dyslexia was even really defined, that understood my learning disabilities. And for several years, she worked with me multiple times a week after school to help learn how to read and to correct. Dyslexics tend to read right to left. Almost all of them will tell you if you try to read a speech, you'll lose your spot on it. We just think differently. It's like if you follow sports, it's like getting a curveball every time. But once somebody teaches you that when a curveball comes to you, you take it to the right field every time, you can all of a sudden play a different game. And so what dyslexics do, and we talked earlier about it, Peter, is that we almost think alike in terms of how we approach problems. If somebody gives us to us serially, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, we'll get lost, whether it's directions, speech, anything else. But if we're able to gather in the data, picture the whole picture, almost visualize it, then we can execute perhaps at speeds that others cannot. And so you take a weakness, make it a strength. It doesn't mean it still isn't a weakness. It clearly is. And I could never make an A in English. No matter what I did, I could make any grades I wanted in other topics. But it was the ability to take a weakness and make it to a strength that I didn't realize how much confidence it gave me later in life. And at the time, I just didn't want anybody to know about it. And so it is an awareness of a problem than overcoming it. And you're more a product of your setbacks and how you handle them in life than your successes. And you're looking at me and saying, John, is that really true of a CEO? Yes, it is. And it's true of kids. Yeah, and all of us want our kids to be successful and happy. But it's how they handle their setbacks in life we know are so important to do they achieve their overall goals. So having gone through that process, it was huge. And I never mentioned being dyslexic after I left West Virginia until I did it by happenstance in a take our child to work day where a young girl suddenly was having trouble getting out the question. And she broke down in tears and started to walk away and said she was dyslexic. And straight back to her seat, and I forgot my mic was on, and I'd never told anybody at work or in my professional career that I was dyslexic, and I said, I am too, and your hands still sweat when you're dyslexic. The fear, just talking about it, is amazing, even after you handle the weaknesses. But I said, here's how you handle it. You picture what you want to do, take your time, don't try to memorize the question, memorize the concept. And they just talked like we're having a conversation. So what was your question? We went through it. And all of a sudden, I realized the room was really quiet. And I realized I just confessed to everybody and come out of the closet. And I thought I'd actually been too open. Because as a CEO, you at first think you don't want anybody to think you have weaknesses. And that's probably a young CEO who's a little bit insecure. You'll find that over time, really good leaders are very candid about their strengths and limitations. And they're very much aware of them, and they get people around them, and they don't mind talk about them. And so it is that type of lessons learned that prepared me for much of what I did in business, but it ties together the stream that you ask about.
That's really extraordinary, and an extraordinary story that you tell in some detail in the book as well. After getting your MBA at Indiana, you joined IBM in a sales role. Mm-hmm. You went on to Wang Laboratories as a VP of U.S. operations before joining Cisco. Mm-hmm. When you joined Cisco, it was a $70 million revenue company, I believe, mm-hmm. at that time.
That is correct.
And I'm curious, what attracted you to it? What did you see in it after being at these two behemoths and joining this much smaller organization?
Well, it's interesting. Again, the sequence you raised it in, let me kind of comment in the order that you went, is I went to school for 9.5 years in college and 3 degrees, Duke, West Virginia, Indiana, the schools I went to, undergraduate degree in business, then law degree, and then MBA degree. And after 9.5 years in school, the last thing I was going to do was to go be a salesperson, and especially a salesperson in technology, because I didn't even like technology. In fact, I'd usually help my friends on their business premises and on their mathematical equations, and I'd get help on my computer programs in college. And my buddies had come up and interview at IBM, and I said, I don't want to do that, Steve. We're very good friends, but I have no intention of joining them. And he said, but it will make me look good if I can pull people in to interview. He says, I know you're not going to take the job, but it would help me. And I said, Steve, I really like you, but he said, I got 2 tickets to the ball game. I said, I'll be there. And so that speaks to the importance of education and being flexible in life. And very often you end up going a direction you would never dream otherwise would occur. So first with IBM, and then this is where I learned market transitions. I'd seen it in the state for West Virginia and the changes it went through and struggled with to come back from. I saw IBM fail after the mainframe, where it should have been the top technology company today in the world by a factor of 5 or 10-fold, because it had that right and it had the momentum. But they failed to reinvent. They failed to understand the market transitions that came at them from mini computers and then the PC and the internet. So from IBM, I learned what a very successful company is like, but also when they didn't change, just like when the coal industry didn't change and the chemical industry didn't change in West Virginia, how we hit the challenges, I learned to move to Wang, which is the mini computer. And then when the mini computer, and Dr. Wang was a very good friend, smartest man I ever met in my life, but I could not convince him that the future was PC and the internet, even in part because he had built a PC 5 or 6 years before Microsoft and IBM did, and he didn't believe that it was sustainable. And so I saw when we missed that at Wang, 32,000 people eventually lost their job. And so then coming to Cisco, grasping the power of the internet at a time that very few people knew even what the internet was about, and I knew I'd arrived at Cisco and had finally achieved its goal when people quit writing complaint letters to me about my trucks, the Cisco food trucks, which I got a lot of initially. But the point that I'm making is took a risk that I wouldn't have taken without having watched the transitions, and very quickly said that this company has the potential to change the world, change the way you work, live, learn, and play, because it's going to be synonymous with the internet. And that's the chance that we have, both on the business side, but also on the giving back and the inclusion side. And almost no one, including my marketing department, even thought it was possible, and they didn't even like the word change the world through, you know, the way you work, live, learn, and play, and yet we did. And that's kind of exciting about what my next chapter is about. I want to do it one more time. In a world that we're having way too much income disparity, way too much difference based on what part of the U.S. you're in, what state you're in, or what country you're in the world in terms of the ability to get a good paying job. And if the majority of jobs are going to be created in startups or small companies getting much bigger, and the large companies, due in part to technology, will be shedding jobs over this next decade, which unfortunately they will, if we don't get the startup engine going at a much faster pace in this country, and a much more inclusive pace by state and by cities, then we're going to leave behind a large part of our citizens. And that's in part what you see out of the voting patterns occurring today in terms of people both fearful, but also rightly saying, if we don't do something different, we're going to have an undesirable result.
What have been the impediments to that, do you think? At least some of the bigger ones.
No, you're asking it perfectly, and you're following a little bit the sequence in the book as well. Often people tend to think that the mistake people made was because they moved too fast or missed a direction. The real mistake people make is you keep doing the right thing too long. You almost have a feeling that if I continue to do just 3 or 5% better, I'll be fine. That's how I was trained in MBA school, by the way. And yet in this world, if you don't think exponentially, think like a teenager, think out of box on it, you can get left behind with tremendous speed. And this is where I think people have to challenge it. For your audience, the CIOs in part are your audience. What their companies have to do is realize that it took Amazon 21 years to overtake Walmart from the time it started in terms of the financial market's view of its future value, its market cap. It took Tesla 14 years to overcome GM. And then it took Uber 7 years to overcome the value of Tesla. And they clearly have some issues in terms of culture, but they'll eventually probably get that fixed. But you can do the math. 21, 14, 7, the next time will be 3 to 4 years. So it's that speed of change that people have to get really into their thought process. And so our nation has to first quit doing the right thing too long. Secondly, the people listening, they're going to say we're the most innovation nation in the world. Not true at all. We are out of the top 10, according to Bloomberg Innovation Index, for the first time in our history. And the number of IPOs over the last 2 years have been below 200 on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ. And this year, they're probably going to get a little bit over 200. But that used to be 700 per year in the mid-90s when we generated 22.5 million jobs. And the real per capita income of the average American household went up 24% in 8 years. So technology can be the enabler, job creator, and income creator, but only if you fix the education system, only if you create the windows through startups, that's where the jobs will be, and only if you do it with a geographic inclusion and gender minority inclusion basis. Mm.
I'd like to actually ask you a number of questions about startups, especially as it applies to your latest venture, but I actually do want to go back to your time at Cisco. I mentioned when you joined $70 million in revenue, by the time you left, $47 billion or so in revenue.
47.8, I wasn't counting. And 400 people to 75,000 people.
Incredible.
We created 10,000 billionaires in our first decade alone of our employees.
Millionaires.
Yes. So we share the success of the company in a way that no one's ever done before or since, unfortunately.
Yeah. And one of the ways in which you, one of several ways in which you grew was through acquisition. And as we talked about a little bit earlier, John, the vast majority of acquisitions are failures.
Yes.
For a whole range of reasons.
In technology,
mm-hmm. Yes.
And everybody's become a technology company. Yeah. So it does speak to how it's going to affect every industry now.
It's a great point. Cisco was kind of legendary in its ability to acquire and successfully integrate companies as part of the fuel for its growth.
Yes.
And I'd be interested in making the connection point between what you saw in companies that had gone from startup to an appropriate scale for a Cisco to gobble up, and what you're now drawing from those lessons to the startups that you're now advising. But what was the secret sauce? Why was Cisco so successful in its acquisitions and integrations?
Well, I think the secret sauce to Cisco's speed of innovation was how we developed a replicatable innovation playbook. Much like a sports team develops a playbook and then how well you execute off those plays, most companies do not do a playbook for innovation. And they don't learn that startups are where most innovation has occurred in the past, and even, unfortunately, almost all innovation will occur over the next decade. And so it's how you get that replicatable process down, and I used to consider process a dirty word. For those operational people listening to this broadcast, it actually allows you to go dramatically faster. I was just wrong. And the importance of getting a operational playbook that you can run with tremendous speed allows you to not only have a hit rate that no one else had, and 2/3 of our acquisitions were successful, and in high tech, probably 90% of those that are acquired are not successful if you measure it in terms of value to the company, keeping the engineers, next generation product out, gaining market share, etc. So what we did is we said, we're not going to be smarter than others. We're going to say, how do we do it differently? And then we're going to refine very quickly the playbook that allows you to move with speed that others cannot. And the best way to hit it home is that I think everyone in the Valley would say we're the best at doing this. when I was at Cisco. And I even teach a class with Safra Katz, who's the president of Oracle. And they probably have been the second most effective acquisitor in the Valley, according to many people's views, including mine. And she'd say, we just modeled our whole approach after what you did at Cisco. And so I teach a class with her at Stanford. She's kind enough. She teaches it for a full semester. She brings me in for one session on acquisitions. So how do acquisitions tie back to what I'm doing now? The acquisitions, when you look at literally several thousand to select 180 to acquire, you get to see which ones do you acquire, how do you get that rhythm down that allows you to do it, etc. And you get to see those that allow you to disrupt a market and truly one that is gaining market share with sustainable differentiation. So it allowed us, with our internal innovation and our acquisition engine, to move from one product area, something called routers, into 18 major product families, of which 16 of which were one or two. 12 of the 16 were number one. No one's ever done that before or since, with very low barriers to entry. So it was all about the speed of innovation. Takeaway, I could get a call on a Thursday night from the head of the NASDAQ, who was a good friend, and said, John, this isn't anything other than just for your awareness. You should be buying this company, and your competitors are all over it and have been for 6 months. And he was very gentle, but he said, you're an idiot for not already buying this. And I was a little bit embarrassed because I didn't even know the name of the company. And when he said it, I said, what do they do? I felt better when my business development person didn't know it either. But we went to that account the next morning. The business development person went first. And he called me after an hour and a half and said, John, you got to get over here. I met with the CEO. We outlined the vision of what we could do together. I ran that playbook with tremendous speed. We had a handshake at 1 o'clock to do the deal. We had it through both boards implemented, and we were on site Monday morning to announce to the employees for a $3 billion plus acquisition. I'm not aware of any company that's ever moved with that speed before, and also it turned out to be very successful, thank goodness, or my board might have shot me. But it does speak to that replicatable innovation capability that in part I was forced to learn as a dyslexic, how do you know the process, and that I learned to say, how do you develop that process and do it with tremendous speed. So I use that innovation playbook, whether it's digitizing a country with a leader like Macron in France, or digitizing a country, the most populous country in the world, like Modi in India, or how do you do these startups? And so I have my six things that I look in the startups, and then I have here the startups are successful. Then I have modifications of that based on who I want to work with and who I want to invest with my time and mentor and money in.
Can you talk about some of those six factors that you just
sure.
mentioned?
Sure. So for the you want to do acquisitions or startups?
Startups, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
So on the startups.
Sorry, I think why don't we go with acquisitions first as a just taking that sequentially? Yeah.
All right. Well, in terms of acquisitions, what we did that was different than everyone else is we knew they were going to be very hard. Mm-hmm. So we never combined with a company that had a different view of where the industry was going to go and the role that they would play after we acquired them. We never combined with a company that didn't have a similar culture. You say, well, what does culture have to do with this? It's a financial decision. If your cultures are different, you don't hold the people, you don't hold the leaders.
That's a great point.
We'd never combine with a company that I couldn't hold the top engineers and the top leaders. And our attrition rate in an industry that averages 15% as a company, Cisco ran 5% voluntary. Acquisitions, when you acquire them, usually run 20 to 30% in voluntary attrition. People just leave. They don't want to stay with a new company. Ours ran 4%. And so that process of saying, can we keep the people? Then it was always customer driven. Customers would tell me who to acquire. Or I would gently ask them behind the scenes, what do you think about this company on it in terms of the direction? And so we executed this playbook that had three additional rules. I do the same thing with the companies we invest in. First thing is I look, is there a market in transition? Ideally, both business model and technology model at the same time. But the same thing's true of a country, a digital country that is a political transition and people transition and technology enabled. Then I look for the skill of the leader. And that is so important because without exception, without a really great CEO, world-class, capable, the startups aren't going to be successful. And I'd argue the countries when they try to make the transition have the same issues. And I'd want a leader who truly wanted to be coached. If they felt they had all the answers or say they wanted to mentor, but they really didn't, I wouldn't touch it. Then I looked at, are they near an inflection point where they could become the number one or number two player within that area? Then I'd go back to customers. What are your top Lighthouse customers that are referenceable? And I'd talk to the customers on it. Then I'd look at their leadership team, the investors. And while that sounds a little bit bureaucratic, which is what I would have called it 30 years ago, it actually allows you to move with speed you don't get otherwise. And so we've done 16 companies that we've gotten really close to. We are advising France on their startup mentality, and we called it, we become the startup nation in Europe. Mm-hmm. And when I did that 3 years ago, everybody said, not a chance. It's the worst place in the world to do business, which was true at that time. Mm-hmm. But it talks about how they change. Their startups are up fivefold in a period of 4 years in terms of venture capital investment and high-tech startups. And the U.S. has actually decreased. More companies going out of business than into business. So this is why you've got to change. It's that replicatable rule book, if you will.
I want to go back to the point you made about culture. You've mentioned it actually in a few different places and the importance of it, the importance of it in an acquisition, mm-hmm. for example. But also, I'd love to understand, how would you typify the culture of Cisco while you were there? I mean, you had an extraordinarily long tenure, one mm-hmm. of the longest for a Fortune 500, especially in a tech organization, mm-hmm. As a non-founder, multiple decades. You were there as a CEO. You ascended to that role, rather, at 46, so also mm-hmm. very young mm-hmm. When you ascended to that role. Uh-huh. And you were able to exert such influence over such a long period of time. And I'm curious, what were some of the attributes that you really kind of hold dear from a cultural perspective? How did you find those?
Well, start with the key attributes for a CEO, regardless of the size of the company, or a leader in government or other activities, needs to do. The first thing is they're responsible for the strategy and vision of the company. The second thing, they're responsible for getting the right leaders in place to implement that strategy and vision. The third thing that I didn't understand how important it was they're responsible for the culture. They got to own it. And the fourth thing is, basic as it sounds, you got to communicate all the above to all the constituencies, to your employees, to your shareholders, to your customers, to your partners, or if you're a government, to the citizens, et cetera, and the electorate. And culture, I maybe in the back of my mind understood it was important, but not to the degree it is. Culture actually probably is more powerful than strategy. And you
Peter
never...
Drucker has a famous line about that, culture eats strategy for lunch.
Yes. and probably in truth, they're probably equal. Mm-hmm. But what most young CEOs, including myself, or leaders miss is culture is so important. And there isn't a right or wrong culture. You may like the culture at an Oracle or a Cisco or Microsoft or GM or the Bank of America or JP Morgan Chase, or you may not. But you never have great companies without strong cultures. You may like it in Uber, or you may not. But part of the reason they were successful was they had a strong culture, and culture actually is what got broke there that they have to fix. So it is so important to understand, and I teach all my young CEOs how important that is and how much culture will play a role in their success.
Mm-hmm. That's really great. I want to talk about a couple of other things that you mentioned in the book, and it speaks also to some of the big bets you talked about, this mm-hmm. Multi-billion dollar bet that you made, for example. You talk in the book how the biggest regrets you have are not the big bets that you made that were not successful, but rather that maybe you didn't go big enough at times.
Yes.
And it's become an area in which you've advised others that it's important to actually, you know, if you're batting 1,000, you're not innovating. If you're not thinking big, you're not going to do big things. I wonder if you could share some of the insights from that.
Well, the insights, and it started off with a mentality of having watched IBM and Wang. If you don't have at least 20% market share in high tech, you're not going to survive. And if you get 40 or 50 or 60% market share, your odds of survival are very good, especially if you reinvent yourself. So the most basic principle is, if you're not able to really differentiate yourself with certain size and capability, you're not going to be able to be successful. So setting goals that aren't just stretch goals, but audacious goals. GE, Jack Welch taught me that. He actually gave an endorsement to the book as well. But the GE mentality, be one or two or don't compete. Mm-hmm. Right. I took it one step further. I said, Cisco mentality, be one or two, but let's not talk two. And a minimum of 40% market share, which even GE didn't stretch to. And to do this without large barriers to entry, such as huge capital outlays or patents or big fabrication plants, was unheard of. Yet we did it because we set and dreamed big. And we accomplished what so many people thought was impossible, even changing the way the world works, lives, learns, and plays. And my regret was not that I was too ambitious, although some of my critics would say at times I perhaps spread myself too thin, was too ambitious. I respectfully disagree with the ambitious part of that. I think we should have been more. I should have taken more risk, been more aggressive, very similar to what Shimon Peres would often teach me about how important that is, the prior president of Israel, who passed away about a year and a half ago, mm-hmm. a very good friend.
Yeah, and so you've begun to talk a little bit about the work that you're doing in places like France and places mm-hmm. like India. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, and you talked about the amazing progress that's happening in both places. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, I'd love to understand a bit more about the nature of the work. How you talked about the amazing success over the course of just a few years that France has had. What's the magic there? What is the role of the leader, and how can he, like a CEO, for example, how can he bend the culture of an entire nation in order to be more supportive of and cognizant of the need for a different way of doing things?
Well, I think the important thing is to see where the nation is in terms of wanting to change. And you've got to have the courage to see market transitions and know they wait for no one. The U.S. led in the internet revolution, and boy, we got the economic benefits during the 90s. I alluded to it earlier, 34% growth in GDP, 22.5 million jobs, real per capita income, average household going up 24%. America hasn't had a raise since then. And it took the ability of business and government working together toward a common vision. In terms of what you've got in France is a leadership group that got it. And it's so important not to go with your predetermined factors or instincts. I knew Israel would get it. And that's where Shimon Peres and Netanyahu, the prime minister, clearly understood what was capable. But it was only 7.5 million people. And people expect Israel to reinvent itself. So the market wouldn't follow their digitization leads, which they did with Cisco and with me as the representative to do it. I thought it would be the UK or Germany that would move. And neither one of their leaders, even though they intellectually got it, was willing to move with the courage and speed. And when I was told that France was changing and they had startups, more startups at the Consumer Electronics Show than any other nation except the U.S., I said, that's interesting, but you know, France is a wonderful people, a great place to visit, a great place to go for dinner, for romance with your spouse, etc. Last place in the world you're going to put headcount or jobs in a startup. And they said, John, come and look. And I went and I talked to the startups, and it was almost like I was in Silicon Valley, except they had a strong accent. And then I went over and talked to the business leaders, and they said, John, the country's changing. And then I went to what was then a socialistic government. And I less people I would have expected to get this. And President Hollande got it. Prime Minister Valls got it. And a young economic minister by the name of Macron was amazing. And we
In fact, you had the impression upon meeting him that you thought you'd met. You called your wife and said, I think I've just met the next president.
I did. Yeah. I called my wife that day and I said, I think I've met the future president.
Our future
of
president, rather.
Because he was so young. Many yes. people thought that even if he ever did become president, it would be a decade or so later. And I taught classes with him with MBA schools. We did joint press announcement. He is a visionary leader. He's fearless if he believes this is the right thing to do. And we aligned in a way that took the concept of a startup France and a startup Europe and said, here's why it's the benefit of everyone. Even to the point that at the time that you might remember of the management and the Air France unions political strike, where the unions attacked the management, tore their shirts off of them. And I was supposed to announce a strategic partnership in France the next day. The National Public Radio called up and said, John, we want you to talk about what you're going to announce today. Is it the future for France, or is really what we saw yesterday the future? And I said, I'm surprised because it's supposed to be confidential than what I was supposed to announce, but I've got to pass because I've got to go do this announcement. They said, we're going to announce it for you if you don't come on the show. So I went on the show and I outlined why I thought France's future was more about an industry and a country that was ready to change, and the citizens got it and the young people got it. And remember, entrepreneur is a French name. And so we said, here's what's possible. Here's why I think it's possible. And then business and government, the citizens and the press played a huge role in making this happen, educating the country on why it's possible. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to today, it is the startup nation of Europe. They're far from done, and they'll hit bumps along the way. And anytime you dream big, there are going to be setbacks along the way. And it's how you handle those setbacks But I really believe what Macron is doing in France is the example for the rest of the world and something the U.S. could learn from. They're not resting on their laurels, their great cultural past. They're saying, how do we take our strengths of the past, but how do we reinvent and disrupt ourselves for the future? At the other extreme is Modi in India.
Yeah.
1.3 billion people, a leader who truly wakes up every day just saying, what can I do for my country? For those of you who might not be familiar with him, he comes from a very average background in terms of it. He's never taken anything in any way that is a benefit to him personally. He's focused on how does he give back to the country. And he is fearless when he believes something's in the country's right interest. And again, partnered with Prime Minister Modi about digitizing India and what did it mean to GDP growth and job creation and startups and smart cities and how did education and healthcare and security and the environment have to change to achieve this. And literally every time we were together, we'd review where are we on those 10 categories and what role do you want me to play at that time as CEO of Cisco and now as head of the U.S.-India Strategic Partnership Forum. Our businesses working together and our governments working together in a very unique way. I'm focused on a startup mentality and driving it through. And before people blink on this, understand the magnitude of the challenge. India has to create 1.2 million jobs per month for the new young people coming into the economy. And the young people believe in this future that Prime Minister Modi's outlined. But they also, like young people everywhere, are impatient. Let's make it happen quickly. So you see countries that may say their differences are dramatic. And how do you compare the two? And which one has the bigger challenge? Actually, their differences are dramatic, but the challenges are almost equal. And Prime Minister Modi has to lead the biggest country in the world through this transition that has the strengths and limitations of the world's largest democracy. And we know what we're saying there. And President Macron has a challenge of one of the most successful nations in Europe with a tremendously great past and a great history. How do you outline a vision for the future that the citizens buy into in an inclusive fashion? And how do you reinvent and disrupt not only your own country, but disrupt Europe and become the model for Europe? I think both leaders have the probability of that occurring. A lot of heavy lifting in front of them to achieve that goal. But if you're asking which country would I bet on in Europe, it's France. Which country in Asia will surprise you? It would be India.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that overview of each. I'd love to conclude where we began, and that is a place like West Virginia and other states like them. You talked about some of the lessons that we can draw from nations like France and India for the changes that they're going through and the changes we're going to need to in order to make sure that the opportunities are spread more equally across our society.
Yes.
In the work that you're doing in West Virginia, and I know actually in other states as well, can you talk a bit about what you see to be the recipe towards some of the improvements that are necessary there and the role that you see state-level government, federal government, the business community, universities, how they must interplay in order to be successful?
Well, I think it starts with the example of what occurred in Boston Route 128, and then they lost it. And they used to be the Silicon Valley of the world, and now they only have one major high-tech company left. Silicon Valley is the hub of the world innovation disruption, but yet we have no entitlement either. If we don't reinvent ourselves, we will get left behind. And technology has to be very careful. Tech for good was the motto when I ran Cisco. And the importance of technology helping and inclusive on a global basis through everything from network academies to each state and each country seeing the benefits. I think if we do not learn how to reinvent ourselves, if we fall into the trap of how I was trained and others about just do the right thing, continue to do it a little bit better, the results will be dramatically disappointing. So it does require business, government, education, venture capital, the citizens, all having the courage to change and to work together in a way we've never done before at a speed we've never done before. And then it requires visionary leaders who are willing to say, here's what's possible, and willing to bet their own credibility in their future on other things that others perhaps consider dreaming too big. This is not a zero-sum game. It can raise all the boats as the tide comes in. But if the companies or the countries make the mistake of saying, I don't need to change, this is entitlement, the U.S. is still the most innovation nation in the world when we're not, and our trends are clearly going the wrong way, if we don't have the courage to change, we will get left behind. But at my heart, I'm an optimist, And I'm also a realistic optimist. I know what it takes to overcome the issues and how do you work together in ways perhaps it hasn't been done before to achieve this goal. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to change the world one more time. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to be a big part of that with the internet and with Cisco. And I'm trying to do it now with startups, where startups will be the job creator, will be the innovation engine, will be the one that in its inclusion of all the citizens, et cetera, have done right. And to perhaps play a small role in that in my next chapter of my life is very appropriate. I used to think writing a book was something that people could do once you're dead. I really believe that. It was much harder than I ever dreamed to write a book. But I wrote a book for a very simple reason. I wanted it to be a go-to for what's possible when you catch market transitions and how do you dream what's possible as these technology transitions through digitization, artificial intelligence, Internet of Things comes with tremendous speed, and a realization that technology can be both good and bad. It can be a job distractor. And if we don't create a much faster pace of startups and new job creation, we're going to leave behind nations. We're going to leave behind large sections of our own nation. And you want everybody to have a chance to participate in this success, much like we did in the internet era. And I think that's doable. So if JC2 Ventures can really help play a role in that and do it in a way that's really replicatable across many states, 7 at the present time, including West Virginia, which we'll announce here in November, some of the very creative things we're going to do together with the university and the leadership in the state and with startups, and the willingness to dream big and realize that some of the dreams won't happen. And rather than getting down when you are not successful, just like I did with dyslexia, it took me a while to learn. It was very painful. But how do we learn from it? How does it make us stronger? And how do we come back?
Mm. Well, some very worthy goals that you have now for the next chapter of your life. John Chambers, thank you so much for taking some time with me. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Peter, it was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be General Stanley McChrystal.